Now
everybody thinks I'm crazy that I grew up around Bardstown. They're like, what are you trying to sell New York bourbon in Tennessee? What the f-?
Hey, it's episode 327 of Bourbon Pursuit, the podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. We're now on our final episode in our four-part series of Is Bourbon Broken? Based on the multi-part blog series from Bourbon and Banter. We've looked at the consumer, we've looked at the secondary market, and we also looked at distribution and retail. But this time, we're going back to part one and revisiting the consumer, but at a slightly different angle, because we're going to start evaluating the purchasing trend of consumers. Now, don't get me wrong, bourbon and marketing, they really go hand in hand. And because behind every great bottle is an even better story, and that story is the catalyst that sells the bottle. The market is changing, and there are now more craft distilleries than ever. There's younger age statements, and there's non-distilling producers that are putting out products that are like 10 times the price tag of what it really cost the original producer. So what continues to drive this consuming and this purchasing behavior? Well, we'll dig into that here shortly. Enjoyed this week's episode, and now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Bill Webb, who writes me on Twitter, is it wise to use a bottle spout when pouring for tastings? Wouldn't that be the way to control the amount poured in case a person tasting didn't care for the spirit poured? Lastly, would a person be looked down upon for finishing everyone's leftovers of a tasting? Listen, Bill, you can't go and slurp up your buddy's drink after they've put their greasy lips around the rim and gotten their saliva all up in there. I mean, Bill, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and no matter your opinion on that stuff, it's never a good idea to be drinking after somebody, even if there's alcohol involved. In terms of the spout, that is really used to control pouring at bars. I hate them because most of them don't fit on the bourbon bottles that you would see at a nice party. Like getting a spout to fit on an Elijah Craig bottle is very difficult. Like the opening of an Elijah Craig bottle, you have to have a special spout. So no, I am not for spouts. If you want to have even pours, use a metal shot glass or something like that. But yeah, no, don't use one of those things. I'm very much against them. But that's going to do it for this week's Above the Char. Hey, if you have an idea, like Bill, who I suspect is going to ignore my comments and go drink everyone else's bourbon, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or go to fredminnick.com and write me with your Above the Char idea. Until next week, cheers.
Ed Bly and Rising Tide Spirits are back again with a new release of Old Stubborn Bourbon. And this release of Old Stubborn is a premium hand marriage of 10, 11, and 12-year cask strength, barely filtered pot still bourbon. It comes in at a staggering 123.8 proof. And the flavoring grain for this one, which the last one was wheated, but this time it's now rye. Rich, sweet, and bold with a long finish that's sure to be another eye-opener. You can order online at Sealbox or thebourbonconcierge.com. And you can even purchase in person at Revival Vintage Spirits, and even now with very few select stores in Kentucky. You can get it now while you can, but be sure to do it because it's not going to last long.
And they're off for another Get 270 2020 Unicorn Raffle. Your $20 ticket gives you not one, but two chances to win from our lineup of 20 Woodford Reserve treasures, including the grand prize, the rarest unicorn yet, the Woodford Reserve Kentucky Derby 150 Baccarat Edition. Only 150 bottles were made and is just like the one the Derby winning owner receives. Quit horsing around and get your $20 tickets now at give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 0002703.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. Welcome back, everybody, to this fourth installment of Is Bourbon Broken on Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny, Ryan, and Fred all here once again to dive into this fourth part. And credit of this series on Is Bourbon Broken goes to Brent Joseph, who's a contributing writer to Bourbon and Banter. Over this four-part series, we have evaluated Brent's opinion piece on Is Bourbon Broken, and we add our own commentary to expand further on where we see bourbon trending. In part four of Is Bourbon Broken series, we will talk about the one final argument, and that is looking at the consumer once again. In Brent's fourth article, we revisit the consumer problem, and he alludes that consumers are continuing to pay ridiculous prices at retail for bottles of extremely young or sourced bourbon from a myriad of new brands. He points the fingers to places like Blue Run for selling $150 13-year-old sourced bourbon and at craft distillers for selling 2-year-old bourbon for greater than $50, when there's heritage distilleries selling their regular products, which have higher age statements and lower prices. Brent worries that this trend will not stop, and in the words, or should I say in his words, some of you continue to pay double for stuff that is just not good. However, the bourbon community has a chance to stop it, and he says, if customers don't buy overpriced product, the product either goes away or the pricing comes back to reality. So, there's no question that there's a few things happening. First is that there's probably more choice now than ever as a consumer. And second, the envelope is continually being pushed in regards to pricing. So on the first part, as people in the whiskey media, we pay attention to everything that's happening in the bourbon world. Are we seeing an overabundance of options on the market? Or Fred, do you think it's just in line with the times?
It's in line with the times. And if a distiller's coming out and they're $20, they're not going to sell, because I'm in Total Wine the other day and there's this... There's this guy just kind of looking at the shelf, and you know, some of the attendants and I start talking, and he wants our opinion on what to get. And one of the things that came up is like, well, that's just a little too cheap. I don't think I want to get that. He paid $60 for something because that was the amount of money he was going to buy, or that was the amount of money he was going to spend. And it did not matter that what we were recommending was $40 less and better than that $60 product. I mean, I think in the whiskey media, we communicate to people in a bubble. I think people that we are communicating to, and the Bourbon and Banter, you know, people who read that, I think that we think very differently than that gentleman who is walking into a store who is a consumer of bourbon, but is not a consumer of bourbon media. And I just think,
or would you consider him an enthusiast, maybe?
Yeah. This guy spends a lot of money according to the people there. And they just have something in their mind. And I've seen this play out time and time again. People have it in their mind that, you know, something that's more expensive is better. And that mentality is hard to, you know, get people to break away from. And like, the brands have to price themselves where they get purchased. That's the truth of it. And so these new brands that are coming out, they're new and they're shiny, and you know, people want something different, you know. And Blue Run is a very similar run to 15 other bottles on the shelf, but they're priced at a premium and they're getting a very different look than a lot of people, to include like that gentleman yesterday. So, I mean, this is a real problem. And I think of all the things that we have talked about, it's the one that we can't solve.
Well, I feel like if you want bourbon to be broken, then you stop buying all this stuff. Because I think if you want bourbon to continue to flourish and to continue to grow, then you're going to have, people are going to have to embrace these products, these higher age statement, higher price points, because that's paving the way for the future of this hobby. You know, it's, you can't, $20 a bottle is, you know, back when stuff was priced, no one gave a shit about bourbon. That's why it was priced that way. People give a shit now. And, you know, and we got to embrace that. And if we want to keep moving forward, we're going to have to keep investing and keep buying stuff. So if we just stop and saying, we're just not going to buy this stuff, you know, but it's, yeah, I don't know.
And it's like also how bourbon was built. Bourbon was not built to compete with Scotch. You know, it was built to be more of an everyday pour. It was built to be something that, you know, a farmer could drink or a doctor could drink or a plumber or a mechanical engineer. I mean, this is supposed to be the category for all people and for people that, you know, where value is more important than luxury. And that's how it was built. And now that is, you know, skewing more toward the luxury side, you have this enormous gap of, you know, under $30 products to the 60 and above. And every year, you know, the mark of what is value goes up. I mean, I remember writing stories when the mark of value was $15, then it was 20, then it was 25. And now, I mean, if I'm not saying something is $60 is a value, then there are people who are like, man, that's a really good value. And it's like, you can see like the consumer is changing. It's changing.
Like $75 used to be like, oh boy,
this is a lot of money.
And now I'm like, if it's under 75, I'm like, that's a great deal. You know,
what am I waiting for? I'll take three. And that's kind of what goes back to when we were originally doing our whiskey quickies. We were trying to figure out how do we judge all this sort of stuff. And there's a lot of people out there and they put a weight on the value or the price of it and where it regards and stands to them. And we decided early on and said, we're not going to put any weight on the price of the bourbon. We're going to judge it on the whiskey in itself, because what's $20 is a value to one person, $200 is to somebody else. And it's hard to figure out and say, oh yeah, for us, this is where it's at. Like, it's got to be a solid $50 bottle. If it's a $500 bottle and it's some of the best stuff you've ever tasted, is that a value? I don't know. The whiskey's just damn good. Like, that's what it kind of boiled down to. And so, Ryan, you know, I posted at Fred, but I kind of want to post it to you too. I mean, do you think that what we see with on the shelves, I mean, you can go to Total, you can go to any of the large liquor stores and you can see like the bourbon aisle just goes, like it doesn't stop going. And there is an abundance. Do you think that is in line with the times, or do you think that there's just too much out right now?
No, I think it's in line with the times. I mean, people are thirsty and hungry for, you know, they've had the, you know, so-called value brands, and those are all great. And it is hard to argue that, you know, a Knob Creek 10-year-old is, or a Four Roses small batch, or, you know, those Russells that are, you know, priced at $40, $50, $30, that they're not better than some of these. But it's a hobby that there's so much flavor difference out there, and you can search and find so much nuance and differences and different things about all these brands. And it's you got to have that people want that. You know, we do it. I mean, look at your bar. It's a, you know, I've had this discussion with people. I'm like, you know, vodka drinkers or tequila drinkers, they're typically like, you know, I'm going to buy my Tito's, or I'm going to buy El Jimador, you know, or a rum is like, I'm going to buy this. Not with bourbon. Probably I would love to see how many average bottles a bourbon drinker has. It's got to be north of 10, you know, and that's pretty crazy, you know.
Even someone who doesn't consider themselves
bourbon
enthusiasts. Yeah, like I met with the lawyer the other day, and we were talking about like what he has in his collection. He's like, yeah, I'm not much of a bourbon drinker. He named off 12 products that he has on his shelf. 12.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I'm not really much of a bourbon drinker.
And like, yes, there's a lot of bad product out there, a lot of bad offerings, but me, I'm still interested to try them. I'm like, it's like, ooh, you know, what's going on with this brand? What's that? You know, I'm interested. And like, I think as people get into this hobby, we all started there where we're like, oh yeah, you know, $20 Weller 12 was, you know, everyday thing. But well, A, we can't find that, but you kind of get bored with that. And you're always just looking for new, better things, different flavors. And you see it in wine too. You know, you have your like staples that you're like, yeah, this is good, but what's that? You know, and you're always trying to like push the envelope. Well,
having like having cut my teeth on wine, the wine industry is so very different. They actually took a cue from the spirits industry, like going toward like branding. You know, Silver Oak is a good example. Prisoner is a good example. But wine was always about region. And so it was either French or Italian, and then it would be broken down, you know, Tuscany, you know, or France, like Bordeaux, Burgundy, things like that. And so these things would always be, you know, broken down. And now it's more on the branding side. And that is the next evolution for bourbon. So bourbon is kind of like going more toward what, you know, wine used to be. And you're starting to see like a lot of geographical changes in a lot of different styles. And you all are part of that. You know, 20 years ago, if a brand tried to put a blend of straights on the shelf, they'd have been laughed out of a liquor store.
From three different states, yeah.
Yeah. And then now...
Everybody thinks I'm crazy that I grew up around Bardstown. They're like, what are you trying to sell New York bourbon in Tennessee? What the... You know.
And now that's all in vogue. So that's the kind of like the trend. And that's an exciting part for me is the new styles that we are seeing. They're actually not new styles. They've been in the books, but no one's played around with them. You know, Barrel's great at it. High West is great at it. You guys are playing around in it. You're starting to see brands like Oregon Spirit kind of come out with products that, you know, 5-10 years ago, never would have given the time of day. And now they're like, you know, they're bringing the heat. And so that part is very, very exciting. And when you start seeing that kind of spread out and you see the competition, you know, kind of even out a little bit, you know, I think, you know, and I'm not an economics guy, I'm not an economics professor, but I think that what you will see is that you will see like we're eventually going to hit a price point that is, it's going to hit. And then everything is going to kind of revolve around that. And it used to be like Maker's Mark was the price point. And then it was like Woodford Reserve were the two price points that you wanted to be in between or around, like when you were starting a new brand. And like now it's just kind of like an entire shelf. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know when that ceiling is going to hit, but it is fascinating to just observe a liquor store shelf from month to month to month to month. It's fascinating.
Yeah. See how it rotates.
And like, bourbon drinkers to me, along with like wine drinkers, it's not, you know, bourbon drinking. Yeah. While yes, we like to have fun and, but it's an experience. I want to show off and find those new brands, those new flavors. Be like, oh, you haven't had this? Try that. You know, yeah, of course you've tried Knob Creek before. It's great. But what about this? You know, and it's just this whole experience. I don't know. That's the mindset I think a bourbon drinker gets.
Yeah.
And I think you look at it from a crafts point of view where you can try to find a lot of those different nuanced flavors at younger ages, because there's a lot of good craft whiskey that's coming out at 4 years old. And I think we've always said it before that in the next 2 to 4 years, I think we will see a huge surge of really good craft whiskey that's been on the scenes because now it's finally starting to age. I think one of my things I look at is that, Ryan, to kind of go back to what you were saying earlier, is that you have all these brands that have been out there and that you've tried. And we know that a few years ago that there was a lot of people that got on the MGP and people were trying a lot of MGP and they found out they really liked 13-year MGP and older than that and completely wiped out the market on what was available out there. And so now we see brands having to readapt themselves and saying, okay, now we've got to sell 3-year or 5-year MGP to kind of stay afloat. I am concerned, and kind of goes back to the consumer problem, is that why are consumers, and this is like, I think OKI is a very good example of this. OKI was originally 11 to almost 14. I think they came out with a 15-year-old bourbon at some point, and now they push 4- and 5-year-old MGP, yet consumers are going crazy for it.
We're talking post new riff sale.
Yeah, post new riff sale, right? Yeah. So now they're starting to put out, you know, 4- or 5-year-old MGP, 36%. It's literally just the same, I guess you say the same exact stuff, just, you know, 10 years difference or 11 year, you know, you do the math there. But why are consumers still going towards brands that are still pushing younger age?
It's the story. It's the brand behind it. They're like, this is the, you know,
but you it's not the same people, though.
It isn't, but people still have that, like, memory of it. Or I kind of try to wrap my head around this, too, and especially with, like, Smoke Wagon, you know, because I'm like, what is the craze about this? You know, it's 5- to 6-year MGP. Like, I just don't understand it. But then you try it, and you realize, wow, he's pretty good at blending it, and it's got some good flavors that I'm not used to with
he's also like contract distilling and
yeah,
and you know, and he gets a little bit of pick of the litter too, and like it, and it is not always, you know, the same. There are like some little differences here and there with some of these MGP brands, but I, you know, going back to the pricing thing, another company that does like some MGP sourcing, Old Elk is a very affordable price point. And I think, you know, when I think of brands that I really like what they're doing, that's one of them, you know, and they're in that $40 to $60 price point. They're not over gouging. And the whiskey is usually very, very good.
Yeah. But I liked how they kind of pivot, like, and kind of focused on like not just the standard MGP.
Yeah, they weren't just taking 36%.
Like they made their own, and then they really nailed it with the wheat whiskey for me.
That's, exactly.
That stuff's fantastic. If you've never had their wheated product, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think Old Elk is like crushing it. And I think of like the new brands we talk about and they're coming out. I'm like, that's to me, that's one of the really good ones. And of course, that's got the former master distiller Greg Metz behind it. But, you know, this comes up and, you know, Chris Hart brought this up in social media not too long ago about like, if you're a brand like, and you've got 3 to 5 year old, juice that you're coming out with and you're pricing it at X, just stop. And it's like, I always look at like, you know, people make business decisions based on their margins and what they need. It's a risk that you take with however you price it because the consumers will react to it. And if you don't have something that's special that warrants $100 price point or whatever it is, don't expect to sell another bottle.
Yeah, and there's a difference too, but it's like who's behind the brand, who's doing the blending, who's doing what's, because there's a lot of people just trying to capitalize on the bourbon boom, and they're just like, oh, we'll buy some source product, throw a label on it, throw it out there, and $150 price tag. And I don't think, I'm not sure who's behind the okay, I can't remember, you know, but I
forget who it was sold off to as well. But
you know, like Blue Run, for example, you know, at first you're like, well, I mean, it's just Barton, you know, it's like another Barton source product. But then right. You try it and you're like, man, somebody did some really good blending or good picking of single barrels here because it's Barton, but it's an elevated Barton, you know, so you got to look at who's behind it. But a lot of everyday consumers aren't going to look at that. And so they're just looking at that price tag and they're like, oh, $50, $60, that must be better than the, you know, the other lower price pointed products.
So. And they also came out at a time when, if you think about it, today's market, putting a big 13 on the label, that means something.
Yeah, because there's not many age products out there.
5 years ago, you'd have been like, 13-year-old whiskey's everywhere. Like, what are you trying to prove here? Today, it's really hard to find a lot of those, anything that's double digits. So you start looking at it and say, okay, well, now if you were to start a brand and you have those double digits, it means something to a consumer. They see that.
I can't tell me how many bottles of Calumet I see at like just friends and families and, you know, and it's all age stated, you know, and you're like, I was like, I didn't know anybody bought these, but it makes sense because it has, they're like, it's 12 years old, you know, it's gotta be good. Right. And you're like, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, Calumet's an interesting one. That was one that I was really against for a long time, from a flavor perspective.
I was gonna say, I'm curious why here.
Not them as people, but it was just
you
like...
You just don't like their horses? Is that what it is?
Well, I just never tasted one that really did it for me. And then I tasted, you know, one of the releases that was really good. Then I got their 15-year-old one recently, you know, and it was a 15-year-old for $109. I bought it at Costco and I was like, oh, this is good. And you know, they were pricing it pretty good. You know, $100 for a 15-year-old Kentucky straight bourbon, that's solid.
Yeah, there's other ones charging $1,500 for it.
Yes, you know? there's definitely some price hikes in that area. So like, you know, I think Calumet, you know, they've been doing it for a while and, you know, and I think they're starting to get some of the choice barrels because they've been doing it so long. And that therein is really where everything lies. It's like the people who have relationships and can get the good stuff, kind of like Aaron from Smoke Wagon, Calumet, you know, people who can get those sweet barrels, you know, that those are the ones who are going to hit.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this already, that anything in the source world, it's always going to come with a higher price tag. And mm-hmm. there's just no way around it, because if you're not distilling it or you aren't contract distilling it, starting it from the very start, it's really hard to kind of keep those numbers low. However, we know that if you have a story in a package, then it's likely to sell. So as a bourbon enthusiast, many of us know where, as we talked about earlier, Blue Run, we know exactly where it's sourced from, but we still want to try it anyway. You know, it's like, we don't want to just say like, we've had that before. We're still intrigued by it. We still want to try it. You know, is it just something that's in our psyche as bourbon enthusiasts that we just can't stop ourselves from trying something new that may not actually be new?
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory,
Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/bourbon. Is it just something that's in our psyche as bourbon enthusiasts that we just can't stop ourselves from trying something new that may not actually be new?
Yeah, that's a good point. I like to try everything. It's like, how could this batch of Barton be different than that batch of Barton? But it is sometimes, you know, and
we do the single barrel picks,
yeah,
and we see them side by side.
It's that, and that's the exciting part, and that's why I've always said bourbon is the perfect product, because it's so hard to replicate. You can replicate it, but you have to do it in big scale, but you can find nuances on a small scale. And that's what's so fascinating about it, is that you can take a product that's an everyday product and have a completely different profile, because you can pick barrels that are from this part of the warehouse that taste completely different from that part of the warehouse. And that's what's fascinating about it all. And that's what keeps you interested, because you're like, what if this is the secret batch? What if this is the one?
Remember, you always talk
that's going to win San Francisco.
You always talk about
Ascot Awards,
those special barrels, right?
Yeah,
you always talk about that.
But then you walk into a rickhouse and you're like, oh, it's just another bottle of whiskey. Why am I getting so freaked out about it? But I can't help myself. I still fall sucker to it every time.
Yeah, and I'm always amazed too when I haven't seen a bottle before, you know. And then so it's like, I got to find out what this bottle is all about. You know, who's making this? Where's it from? Who's the owner? You know, and usually there's a, if I don't know the person, there, you know, there's a degree of separation. But it's just kind of fun. You know, this is, as much as it is how I make my living, it's also like a hobby, like collecting baseball cards, of just like, even if I don't buy the card, I want to read the player statistics and I want to see the photo, what year it is and everything. So I think there's something to be said for that. And what I don't get excited about are like the Woodford Reserve, like Derby bottles, you know, that, because there's nothing different in that. It's just a Derby bottle. I'll look at the art, but I won't buy it. I'll appreciate it. But if it was a 12-year-old Woodford Reserve in there, I'd be freaking buying that all day long. But it's not. So I get really excited about finding the source of these things. That's my fun part. And you got to remember, like, my book Bourbon Curious, when that came out in 2015, nobody talked about where they got their product from. Nobody disclosed their mash bills. And I disclosed all of that stuff for everybody. And now, like, there's like a bigger voice of transparency, and that's absolutely amazing. And you pick up some bottles, and they'll have mash bills on there, and they'll say, this is sourced and it's stored at this warehouse. And this, I mean, I just get all excited seeing like the level of detail on labels. And I don't think that had anything to do with anything in this conversation, but.
Well, no, I mean, I think it goes to what you're also saying, is that when we look at it from a consumer point of view, and if you look at it from a distiller's point of view, is that bourbon is very malleable in the fact that we could take a barrel and you can bottle it, but if you proof it at 85 versus 90 versus 95 versus 100 versus 110, I just named off six different product lines right there.
No. I know you gave Weller's business model, Heaven Hill's business model, you know, and
you do that. You put it in a different part of the warehouse. You buy barrels from New York. You age them in Memphis for a year. It's a completely different product. And that is something that I think, as a bourbon consumer, bourbon enthusiast, we have a story behind these, but at the same exact time, bourbon changes. It changes very easily. And so when you think of, I think I've tried everything out there, I don't think you have. There's going to be no end in sight for when you could say that, oh, I've tried this before, because odds are that batch is different from this batch. This is a little bit different proof than this proof. This was, you know, this had, you know, sun shining down on it for 3 hours a day versus that one had 9 hours a day.
This one's now has it aged in glass. And, but it is crazy if you go to like any website to find like mash bills and you look at all the Kentucky mash bills, they got to be within 5 to 10 points of each other on each mash bill, you know, 70 to 80% for the first number, you know, 10 to 15 on the second, and then 0 to 3 on the third. It's like that they're all pretty similar. And then, but there's just so, like you said, it's very malleable. There's so much change in the product as it in different places. And it's wild.
Yeah, there's a lot of play. So I want to also touch on Brent's comment of some of you continue to pay double for stuff that is just not good. And I think if bourbon has taught me anything so far is that no one can agree on anything. And bourbon is so polarizing that everyone can have their own opinion and it's on taste, and it probably won't matter unless Fred Minnick puts out a bad review on it. So when we think about this...
Wait, you wrote that?
I wrote that. No. Okay. I wrote that. He didn't say
that. I was
going
to say, I don't remember that.
But I mean, that it just kind of shows that whether we come out with 18 different product lines, you're going to have the people that like it, half the people that don't like it. And it's just going to be, gosh, how many times we've talked about how the music you're listening to, what you had for lunch, how everything is going to change the way that you feel about a bourbon on that day, that it's hard for you to sit there and write something off on day one sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, I try to tell people to taste for themselves as much as possible. You know, don't listen to me. Don't listen to other critics. I mean, just use this as a guide, which, you know, I think we've all said on this show. And if you can't taste for yourself, decide for yourself, and you need other people to tell you. You know, that's a dangerous way to spend money, because, you know, you're going to buy something eventually that you don't agree with.
But so, that's how the listicles get made. The top 10 bourbons for, you know, dead heat of summer.
We could do an entire show.
But here's the thing. It's like, they're all going to sell still. It's just a matter if they're going to get opened. Yeah. That's the thing, which is crazy about bourbon. You know, like, people are still buying it. They just may or may not open it based on a review.
One of the best comments I ever got from a distiller was like, you know, your bad reviews sell as much bourbon as your good reviews because people want to see if you're right. And I was like, huh, that's a pretty good testimonial.
Yeah,
that is true. I'm always like, somebody's like, oh, this is bad. And I'm like, I want to try it.
I know, like, I mean, that's the whole reason why Malort's even around, that awful liqueur from Chicago.
Cue the cough. I mean, it's just couldn't have been better timing right there.
But also, I think, like, at the end of the day, what people are paying additional money for, there's usually a good consensus that, you know, likes it. To each his own, taste for yourself. And if you have that money and it doesn't hurt you to spend it, I would ask that you, like, if you see it and you know it's overpriced, maybe see if you can buy it somewhere else where it's not overpriced, because that therein is what pushes the equation further to like hurting the, you know, the system.
Well, what is the context of the question?
Yeah, I think Brent's argument was to say that, you know, a craft distiller comes out with a 3-year-old product and they price it at $60.
Did they distill it?
Yes.
Okay, they got to make money. You know, it's that simple. I mean, and $60 I think is a reasonable price for a craft distiller. Cannot be, you know, looked at in the same eyes as Jim Beam. Like, you just can't do that. And I remember when Peerless came out and they were like $90, and man, they took it on the chin. They took it on the chin. Garrison Brothers, you know, comes out a very high price point with their Cowboy product, took it on the chin. I was very vocal about them being too expensive and, you know, in comparison. But, you know, when someone else wants to put up $20 million to build a distillery, to hire people, to have, you know, build warehouses and all that, you know, and then I'm like, you know, you get a say in how that particular product's priced. Now, whether or not, you know, people are buying it, it's not a charity buy, but it's a small business buy. It's like the same reason why I'm going to a local shop to buy a candle instead of Hallmark, because I'm wanting to support a small business. It's why I'm spending more money on eggs at a farmer's markets, because I want to support the farmer. But it's that type of business strategy versus a strategy of winning over on the shelf from a value perspective. But, you know,
and I think people too need to start getting used to younger age whiskey. It's just going to be the norm, because it's going to keep coming. or the bourbon industry is just starting. And
well, and then the old stocks are saturated.
Exactly. The old stocks are gone. They're gone. And it's going to take a while for that to catch up. And mm-hmm. it's like, okay, I loved when Macaulay, you know, with the Wilderness Trail was like, don't come here looking to taste a 10 to 12 year old bourbon. That ain't what we got. But what we got is something pretty good at 4 to 5 years. And that's very true.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's your expectation? And it's like, and it's who's the people making this brand? You know, if like Pat and them, I love them. I love supporting them. I want to see them grow and flourish. I want to buy bottles, support right. them, you know? It's like same with that craft distillery. If I go there and I meet the people behind it and see how hard they work and, you know, the people and the story behind it, that makes me want to invest in them. And so we can taste their 10 to 12 year old product. But there are brands that are just out there to make money on a boom and they're not putting the passion and the hard work behind it. And that's where probably I have the problem with it. But there's a lot of good working, hardworking people that I want to support in this industry.
So back to the sort of pricing thing, and I know I can't be alone in this. We all get the same exact question, and it's whether it's Christmas time or a birthday, and they're like, oh, my dad, my mom, my friend, my boss, whatever. Can you give me a recommendation that's around $150? And I think about that, and I try to think. I'm like, gosh, there's only three or four brands that always come to mind. That's like Kentucky Owl, Fourgate, maybe like Old St. Nick from Preservation. But I think about this and I'm like, okay, well, what they're coming out with, yeah, some of them are, you know, they have some source of products, some of them have some larger age statements. You know, Fourgate does something that's very unique. Every single release is different. They do a bunch of finishing that justifies some of that price point. But I look at it and I'm like, why aren't more distilleries or NDPs just coming out with another brand and just shoveling it at $150 and saying, there we go, now we can hit this mark as well.
Come out on Black Friday.
Then we would have an entire conversation about, does this, the new wave of $150 bourbons mean bourbon is broken? You know, yeah. I mean, it's.
But I mean, I look at it from a business perspective. Like, why not put out a few cases and just have another thing that's out there on the shelf?
I think because you got to be a long-term thinker. If you're just wanting to cash in short-term, yes. But if you're trying to build a brand that's going to be around for a long time, you have to create and add some type of value. Yes, you can cash in on that one time a year purchase for Christmas, but that's not going to sustain a brand. You know, I see those bottles sit all year long until Christmas time or Derby time, you know, and that's just not sustainable. If you're going to, it's hard to be a premium brand only. I can't think of one that's just that. And that's all they are. I mean,
well, Pappy, I mean, the
Van. Well, I know, but they have a whole line underneath them. That's, you know, damn, they went out of business, you know, way back in the day. So, but they had a whole line underneath them. They had Cabin Still and, you know, Old Fitz and all this.
You were talking about in the Stitzweller days. Yeah, you know, that is a frame of thinking. Like, if they're going to, like, create something to put out, it better be damn good, you know. And I look at something like, you know, once you go past that $100 threshold, and we brought up Calumet earlier, that 15-year-old that they put out, man, it's good. And, you know, Elijah Craig, 18-year-old, it's good. Although I missed the days when it was $35. But, you know, it better be good and it better have some age to it. And, you know, no one's buying the Abraham Lincoln bottle, you know, that's priced extraordinarily high.
I forgot about that.
Somebody must have bought it. I don't see him around anymore.
Oh, I still see him. Yeah, I still
do
see
you really?
Him.
Okay.
I think the liquor stores are just like, they've just taken him down. They haven't sold. They just moved him in the back because they're like embarrassed by him now.
That's a tough risk.
Just rotate him everywhere.
Yeah, I just, you know, it is a difficult conversation when someone's like, hey, I've got $150 to spend. And you tell them you should spend $60. Instead
yeah, it's a tough conversation to have. It's not to say I don't value your boss's work, but there's just no bourbons at $150 that I could say, yeah, go and get this one every day of the week.
Yeah, there's a huge discrepancy in value from that 60 to 150.
Like, and they hate it when you mention a brand that they deem as not being high, like Knob Creek 12-year-old. Like, oh, well, but there's regular Knob Creek. And, you know, they just, I don't know. There's just something about like packaging of some brands that just wows people, you know? And it just, I think that might be the issue. It's just like put the same stuff in a bottle that is like slender and has the Van Winkle feel and then be done with it. You know, I don't know.
a cognac bottle. So they're trying to say that's what sells.
Yeah. The cognac just, or the wine bottle. And just,
or even, or Whistle Pig's bottle. Like Whistle Pig, you know, Whistle Pig to me is like one of the most fascinating brands because right now it's outselling like a lot of the core products at major auctions. They're allocated. They're getting like deals with like major musicians. I mean, they're on fire. And they bought up all the Alberta rye that was left. They bought like 600-700 barrels of some of the lock, stock, and barrel kind of rye from Alberta. They're just like crushing it. And so I look at like a brand like Whistle Pig, and I'm like, how did they escape like all the criticism? And is it just because as simple as like they are not bourbon and they're rye? Is it that simple?
Might be.
But Willett escaped it too. It's like they somehow.
Oh no. Willett did not escape. The fan clubs carried him, but believe me, Willett gets plenty of criticism. People just aren't as vocal about it because they still want to try and get a barrel from Drew.
quiet. Everybody, don't say anything about it. No, I'm just kidding. It is true. We've always said that Willett is one of those brands that it gets a pass. It always gets a pass. People tend to overlook it, whether because it's a source product or whether they continue to release stuff at the gift shop for $1,500 a bottle.
And by God, they should get a pass because they
were one of the first to do it. Yeah.
They bought the stocks that nobody else wanted. And
they were smart enough to do it.
I tell people all the time, if it was not for Willett, if it was not for Evan Colesveen, bottling cash strength, older whiskeys, we wouldn't have a bourbon boom. You know, because he kind of like helped pave the way for people understanding what really great bourbon could taste like at cash strength. Oh, sure, Beam was doing it with Booker's as well, but Booker, I mean, it was brand
safe. Yeah, but it was a 6-year-old.
And, you know, he crushed it, and it was largely for the Japanese market. But, you know, if not for that man, you know, saving those stocks, they would have been blended off in Evan Williams. They'd been blended off in Old Fitzgerald and been a bottom, you know, $12 pour or $12 bottle. And, you know, he saved them. And the premium movement of the 21st century, really the credit really does go to Willett and some of its offsprings like Michter's. When I say offsprings, like people that they bottled for.
Yeah. Right. So I guess kind of one question to kind of look at this and, you know, Fred, you had alluded to Whistle Pig earlier. They came out with Boss Hog a few years ago, and that was what, $400-$500?
That's right.
Like that?
Yep.
And that was Dave Pickerel saying, well, we're just not going to let the secondary market
exactly
take anything out of it.
Yeah.
So I don't see any of those bottles on the shelves anymore. They must have sold. So I'm assuming that, you know, whatever was out there is kind of gone. So do we see this as kind of an ever going trend of pricing bourbon where we could see, you know, I just named off like, I need to buy something from my boss and he's going to be $150. What's this going to be in 2 years from now, 3 years from now? I need to buy something for my boss. It's got to be $300. Is there going to be a bottle on the shelf always available that's $300, $400, $500, $1,000? What do we think the future of this is going to look like?
I mean, there isn't cognac. There isn't scotch. You know, there isn't all those other categories. You see them at Total Wine. You're like, who the hell buys it? But somebody does.
I mean, what Dixon came out with, the Kentucky Owl, that was $1,000 bottle, right? I mean, something like that. And
I think, did that come out after Dixon, though? After he left?
I think it was before. It was one of his last projects, but that was $1,000 bottle and it sold.
Yeah. You know, I think, and I think this is going to be a very unpopular opinion, but I think that this is where special blends can live. Like when we say bourbon, I'm thinking of the category. If you want to open that up to American whiskey, I think that this could be a very special place for some of the cool blends, like blend like a really old rye with a really old bourbon and, you know, something else maybe. I mean, there's a lot of room to play with here, but the packaging's also got to match the whiskey inside. And that is where like cognac, they're putting it in crystal. Baccarat and Woodford has that crystal. And you know what? That's coming up in auction, and I picked that as one of my favorite for the auction because my audience for the auction were art collectors, and they understand high-end crystal. So there's a little movement here, but it's got to come with the right packaging. It just can't be a you know, when we're talking $1,000, it's got to be the right packaging.
It has. I guess I always try to compare, and maybe it's wrong, but I try to compare it to like wine, and I see people pay, you know, they'll go to Jeff Ruby's and they'll pay $300 to $500 just for a bottle of wine that you get four drinks out of. And it's like, yeah, but I could buy a $500 bottle of bourbon and get like 20 drinks out of it, you know? And it's like, to me, it just seems like a much better value. You know, I have this expensive gift that I can last much longer than a bottle of wine, but I don't know. I don't know if it'll be like normal, but I think there'll be a lot more of that coming down the road.
And so kind of last point here is that we know that we've all seen the bourbon buying frenzy the past few years, and I don't feel like there's going to be a slowdown, and I don't feel like there's going to be a tipping point anytime soon. So I'm going to have to disagree with Brent when he said that if customers don't buy overpriced product, the product either goes away or the pricing comes back to reality. I believe what we have now is what it's going to be, and it's going to be here to stay for a while.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how, you know, there's a lot of people who think inflation's coming. I know this, that, you know, people drink in good economies and in bad. And if we have a bad economy, if we have, I think world factors play a bigger part in this than, you know, bourbon guy going into a store and dropping 60 bones.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like there's so much more wealth in the U.S. than there was, you know, just 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's like the baby boomers did such a great job at saving and retiring, and they're having these huge nest eggs, and then they're giving it to their children. And then there's just going to be this wealth that just keeps accumulating in the U.S. and they want to spend money, and they want to spend money on high end items. And while there'll be, yes, good and bad times, I think there's just going to be always a premium market, and bourbon's trying to find that voice in there, you know, with wine and scotch and Rolexes and whatever. I think it has found its place, and it's just trying to figure out how it used to be the bottom shelfer to now the top shelfer, and it's trying to find out where that balance is.
The journey of bourbon.
That's right.
From bottom to top shelf.
Drake sings about you.
Well, that's going to be our fifth episode, is when we start talking about from the bottom to the top of bourbon. So.
Yep. Started from the bottom, now I'm here.
But this was a fantastic way to kind of conclude the series on Is Bourbon Broken, a four-part series. So again, thank you, Brent Joseph, for writing that and giving us some really good thinking points to kind of talk about here. But with that, we'll kind of go ahead and wrap it up. Make sure you subscribe to Bourbon Pursuit and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on all the social media channels. And if you like what you hear, make sure you share with a friend and leave us a review. And also make sure you check out our good friend over here on YouTube, as well as his podcast, The Fred Minnick Show.
Woo.
With that, cheers, everybody. And we'll see you all next week.
Talk of six.
Toodles.